Shrink Wrap Radio number 31, April 2nd, 2006. Shamanic Psychology.
Hi, this is Christy of the Psychology Podcast, found at psychology.com. Lean back on the couch, relax, and get ready for another episode of Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
People come to the shamanic traditions wanting to become Indians, and we refuse to work with these people. We're not interested in training Indians or people to shake feathers and rattles, but rather individuals that can bring about healing and transformation to the world.
Bringing healing and transformation to the world. That's the mission of today's guest, Dr. Alberto Violdo, who is both a noted author and workshop leader. For some years now, Dr. Violdo has been training both lay people and professionals in shamanic healing practices through his institute, the Four Winds Society, which is currently located in Park City, Utah. In addition, Dr. Violdo leads trips to Peru and other South American countries where his students get to interact with native healers. It was my good fortune to first get to know Alberto when he was a psychology master's student and I a fairly green faculty member. Since that time, he's gone on to great success, and we've maintained contact as friends and colleagues. So let's get into the interview. Alberto Violdo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's great to be with you and with our listeners today.
Yeah, great. Well, look, you're a world authority on shamanism, and years ago, we won't say quite how many. You were a master's student in my class on altered states of consciousness, and I remember you pulling me aside and saying, David, you ought to go more into shamanism. That's where it's at. And at that time, not many people were talking about shamanism or even knew much about it. And then not long after, you co-authored a book with Stanley Krippner on shaman healers in South America. And now you lecture all over the world. You have a training program in which you train about 2,000 to 3,000 people a year. You've written 7 or 8 books. I hope I haven't given too much of your story away here, but take us on this journey that you've been on. Tell us a little bit about this journey.
Well, you gave the best parts of my stories away. I'm going to have to make some up as we go along.
Right.
No, actually, this was 35 years ago that I mentioned that to you in that graduate course, which kind of dates both of us.
Okay, you've blown my cover.
And the interest that I had in shamanism at that time, which I still have today, was born out of a deep curiosity because students of religion have only studied the traditions that left a written body of knowledge, the literate cultures. So they have studied the Hinduism, they've studied Buddhism and Christianity and Islam and Judaism for thousands of years, hundreds of years, because they left us the Bible and the Quran and
right.
the Torah and the Vedas and the Sutras.
Yeah.
But the traditions that left, that did not leave us a written body of knowledge, the oral traditions, we assumed that those were not important, that they were not very smart because they did not know how to read or write, which means that all of the traditions of the Americas were not studied until anthropologists like Margaret Mead came around and began doing participatory anthropology, experiencing, steeping themselves in the culture and finding what a rich fabric and tradition the oral cultures had. And my interest was in immersing myself in the medical side of these traditions. What were the healing systems? What were the models of health and disease? And at a time in which these traditions were dismissed as being ignorant and stupid because they could not read or write, which is what we assume of people who are illiterate. And what I found was just the contrary. What I discovered was that about 2,000 years ago, a group of elders from the wisdom societies of the Americas got together to track down the future timelines of their people and realize that if they were to invent writing, that they would end up with attorneys, and decided that it was better to do without it altogether. Actually, that's not quite what occurred, but yeah. but what I discovered was an extraordinarily rich tradition of healing that focused not on treating the body, but on working on the luminous energy field, on the blueprint that surrounds the physical body, mm-hmm. and that organizes the body in the same way that a magnet will organize iron filings on a piece of glass.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Margaret Mead and how she immersed herself in the cultures that she studied, and I know that you studied with a variety of shaman healers in South America. What can you tell us about the experiences you had doing that?
Well, at the beginning, I took recorder and camera and notepad and followed the dictates of scientific research, which is to maintain objectivity, and found after 2 or 3 years of doing this that I had chronicled and documented a number of different societies and their mythology and their models of how one gets ill, but I knew nothing about these techniques. Because these techniques are not objective, they are subjective, they're participatory, mm-hmm. they are of the feminine, they're not of the masculine, which insists on separation and observation. So after 3 or 4 years, I threw my tape recorder and camera and notebook into a fire and decided to become a student of the shamans mm-hmm. instead of observing them.
Before we go too much further, how would you define shamanism?
A shaman, let me define who a shaman is, because there is no ism in shamanism. A shaman is an individual who mediates between the visible and the invisible world, who fixes things before they are born. I like to compare to the most famous statement that we have from the 19th century, which is Einstein's formula of E equals mc squared, and where you have energy on one side and mass or matter in the other, and then there's the equal sign. And the shaman is the individual, the man or the woman, that dances on top of that equal sign, that helps things to be born from the invisible world, and helps things and people return to the invisible world at the end of their time. So they are the mediators between the seen and the unseen, between the mythic and the mundane.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. What do you say to the person who might see this interest in shamanism, even though you've corrected me, what do you say to the person who might see this interest in shamanism as a step backwards, as moving toward primitive superstitions?
Well, first let me say what there's no ism in shamanism. It's because it's not organized. It's not mm-hmm. a religion. It's pre-religious or post-religious. And it's actually a spiritual discipline, spiritual practice. And spiritual disciplines are based on experience, on your personal experience, versus a religion which is based on belief, so that a spiritual tradition will always be based on your personal experience, which is what the shaman is. So there's no organized body of shamanism. There are medicine men and women, or shamans. And to the person that believes that this is regressive, I think that it can be, and we have to be very, very careful that we don't simply want to go back to an earlier time when the old growth forests were still present and the buffalo roamed the land, because it's impossible. And in that way, it can become regressive, but anything can from that perspective.
Right.
But the shaman really invites us to revisit our relationship to the earth, to question the myth of progress itself, and invites us to develop a new relationship with nature, particularly at a time when all of the paradigms of the West are crumbling, when we have exhausted the earth, when we have polluted the rivers, when we've contaminated the air. It's inviting us to engage in a new relationship with nature, with our psyches internally, with our own inner nature, and with each other.
Mm-hmm. So something relevant to what you're saying what you're saying now is you're in Florida now. I'll let our listeners know, but a couple of days ago you were passing through California. We had a chance to have dinner, and you said something that struck me about it not being a good idea to turn everybody into Indians. Can you kind of recap that comment and what you meant by that?
To turn everybody into?
Indians.
Indians. Well, we don't want to turn anybody into Indians. people come to the shamanic traditions wanting to become Indians, and we refuse to work with these people. We're not interested in training Indians or people to shake feathers and rattles, but rather individuals that can bring about healing and transformation to the world by working at the essential level of energy, not at the level of moving things, which is the level that medicine works on, but to dream the world into being, to learn to work at the blueprint level of our existence, at the energetic, on the luminous energy field that surrounds the body, for example, to bring about physical change. This is what shamans call dreaming the world into being. I can give you an example of how this works. But to do that, I've got to take us a little bit into the mythology of the shaman.
Okay.
And because the mythology of the shaman is a mythology of the feminine versus our mythology of the West, which is very much of the masculine. So, and remember that myth, that reality, are those myths that we haven't quite seen through yet. Like Joseph Campbell used to say, reality are the myths we haven't quite seen through yet. And let's look at a couple of our myths. Do you know that we have the only mythology in the planet in which we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden?
Hmm.
No one else was cast out of the Garden. The sub-Saharan Africans weren't, the Aborigines or the Native Americans. They were given the garden to be the stewards and the caretakers of the garden. Secondly, as we're being cast out of the garden, there's a voice that says, "And cursed is the earth because of you, woman." And then to the man, the voice says, "And with the sweat of your back, you will take your fruit from the earth, and it shall grow thorns and thistles for you." And I'm not making this up. This is page 2. So right at the beginning of our mythology, we antagonize the feminine. Cursed is the earth because of woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mother, the earth, that will grow thorns and thistles. The voice didn't say, "The earth shall grow mangoes and papayas for you."
Yeah.
No, thorns and... This is the heritage, the inheritance that we got. And then, in a little bit further down in the same paragraph, we learned that, or a little bit further up, that woman was created from man, the story of the rib, of Adam and the rib. In no other mythology in the planet does the masculine give birth to the feminine, or to anything for that matter.
Interesting.
So our mythology is very steeped in the masculine. And then in the year 1564, there was a council of elders of the church in Rome, the Council of Trent, in which they were determining whether animals, Indians, and women had souls.
Hmm.
The first day was determined that animals and Indians, or people of color, did not have souls, which is why they were later worked in the Americas like animals, basically. And it took 23 days of deliberation to determine that women indeed had souls. So our mythology is very, very steeped in the masculine,
mm-hmm.
and becomes dismissive of any tradition that is that is steeped in the feminine. We dismiss it as regressive, as simplistic, because it doesn't fit within the lenses that we'd like to see reality through. So these are traditions of the feminine. They're participatory. They are engaging. Shamans, for example, do not diagnose. They heal. They don't diagnose. They heal. We diagnose, but we don't know how to heal. If you open up a medical text, you find that there's thousands of different ways of being sick, but very few of those are really treatable. And if you really think about it, there's only one or two ways of being healthy, and nobody knows what these are. So shamans don't diagnose, they heal. They differentiate between information and knowledge. We live in an information society, but there's very little wisdom in our society. We're flooded with information. The shaman differentiates between the two. Information is knowing that water is H2O. Knowledge or wisdom is being able to make it rain. Information is having a diagnosis. Wisdom is knowing how to heal that, how to bring the body back into balance.
Right, right. You mentioned Joseph Campbell, and that kind of anticipates one question I wanted to ask you, which was how you see the relationship or points of contact between the shamanic and psychology.
Well, the psychology is an exquisite science of the psyche, and but what happened in psychology is it was born out of our search for the soul. And first we looked for the soul in the liver. We couldn't find it there. Then we looked for the soul in the heart. We couldn't find it there either. Then we looked for the soul in the brain, and we couldn't find it there either. So we kind of dismissed the notion of the soul. And what's happened with psychology is that it's become a bit of a barren landscape. It has suffered from loss of soul. It's lost much of its enchantment, much of the mystery and mystique, and it's become dissective. It's more interested, traditional psychology, in dissecting, analyzing, and interventions that are behavioral, and adjusting behavior. The mythic element of psychology has been lost. Carl Jung and the Joseph Campbells were the great proponents of it. But it's become more of a source of curiosity for psychologists rather than something they build into their practices. I think what we are challenged to do today as psychologists is to reinvent the field, is to reanimate it, is to bring the anima, the soul, back into the field of psychology, mm-hmm. make it a bit more animistic. Look at the journey of the soul and not just the journey of a victim who's recovering from abusive parents. Please, that is so desecrating of the essential nature of a human to be when we begin to self-diagnose ourselves as being crippled by abandonment issues, as suffering from mommy and daddy problems,
mm-hmm.
as being the children of dysfunctional parents, where we hold past generations responsible for who we are. It's not a journey of power and of beauty, which I think is really what the soul clamors for.
Mm-hmm. I think that when psychotherapy works, that good psychotherapy has elements that I would consider to be shamanic. And on a previous show about neuro-linguistic programming, I managed to offend my guest by remarking after the interview that I thought the approach was less science and more shamanism. And later I tried to explain that to me, saying it was shamanic was not a bad thing. And in fact, I think there's a strong shamanic element in good psychotherapy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there is. In good psychotherapists, there's a very strong shamanic element. They're individuals that know how to work with transference, for example, in a very creative and powerful manner. So in the great psychotherapists of our times, the Virginia Satirs, the renowned psychotherapists, the Milton Erickson's, they were individuals that, of course, NLP tried to model the structure of the magic that they brought to their patients. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to model only the use of language when these individuals were working with body movement, with gesture, with nuance, with silence, with presence, with an energy that they radiated. And and they brought about extraordinary transformation on their clients. So the great therapists, I think, have a strong element of the shaman, because she is able to help the client birth from their own invisible world the resources that will bring them to health and to healing.
Okay. Now, you've got a teaching organization. I mentioned at the top of the show that you train somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people in shamanic thinking, shamanic practices, and you have an organization called The Four Winds. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, the Four Winds Society, what I do is we train Western shamans. And our teaching staff includes a Jungian psychologist, a Jungian analyst, a neuroscientist, MD, a wide variety of people that are all trained as Western shamans as well. And we train them in the four core healing disciplines of shamanism, of the medicine way. And I'd like to review these briefly. The first one is the illumination process, where we learn that there's a luminous energy field that surrounds the physical body and an information field, a blueprint of the body, and that you must clear the blueprint in order for physical or emotional healing to happen. Otherwise, you can remove the tissue or the organ, and if you don't clear the blueprint, physical illness returns. If you don't clear the blueprint, the emotional pattern is replayed again. So the first is the illumination process, clearing, overwriting the blueprint, so that we don't keep repeating those same behavior patterns and then pass them on to our children. This is what they call in the jungle generational curses, where we were not able to heal it ourselves and we pass it on to our children, or we inherit it from our mothers, the wounds of our parents, the wounds of our grandparents. The second intervention is the extraction process. Now, in psychology, we believe that all of the energies and emotions that we feel belong to us. The shaman understands that not everything that you experience or you feel belongs to you, that some of these energies can be intrusive energies that are being directed at you from somebody that you angered or somebody who believes that you're responsible for their unhappiness, or somebody you are divorcing or happen to break up with, where you suddenly go from being an angel to being a demon. And these energies have to be extracted. They have to be drawn out of the system. They cannot be. There's no amount of talk therapy that's going to address the toxic effect of these energies on the body. But not only are there intrusive energies, there are intrusive entities as well, which, as you know, we did away with in psychology quite a while back. But let me tell you a story. When my previous to my last book was coming out, Shaman Healer Sage, in Shaman Healer Sage, I described the healing modalities that we're talking about. And Random House, the publisher, invited me to go back to New York and make a presentation to the sales force. And the and my talk, my 15 minutes were right after lunch. And nobody knew what a shaman is, and they weren't interested.
Oh, these what were a challenge.
The national sales force that sold to the Walmarts and to the Borders. And in the middle of my 15-minute talk, this man walks in, and everybody perks up, and he raises his hand, and he speaks to the group, not to me, and he says, "You all know I've had a problem with alcohol for the last 10 years, and I went to see one of Dr. Violdo's graduates, and I've had two sessions with her, and that was 4 months ago. I've not had a drop of alcohol since, and my craving is gone. Thank you very much." And he gets up, and he leaves.
Wow.
And it turns out that he's one of the heads of the publishing company.
Oh, my goodness.
That came in unannounced, and suddenly everybody's interested because everybody in publishing in New York has a problem with alcohol, or many of them do. And the and I'm wondering to myself because we know how complex addictions are. Addictions are very complex issues. And as soon as my talk is over, I call our graduate and I ask her, "What did you do?" And she says, "Well, this man walked into my office, and walking in right behind him, I sensed that right behind him was his father's spirit." And I asked her, "What did you do?" And she said, "I helped him to die." Now, his father had died 10 years earlier and had been an alcoholic his entire life and had become attached to his son. And the minute that his father was able to go back home, back to the world of spirit, the son was able to change his behaviors.
My goodness.
Now, this doesn't mean that all alcoholism has an intrusive entity involved. In this case, this happened to be so. But there's no amount of talk therapy that will deal with grandma or dad who's trapped between the worlds in a nightmare that they cannot wake up from, and who gravitate to the person that they have the most unfinished business with and attach themselves to them.
Okay. So that was related to stage two, extraction?
And that's number two. That's the second intervention that we work with.
Okay.
The third is the soul retrieval process, where the shaman or our students learn that it's possible to journey along your timeline to the past to find an original event that derailed your destiny, an original wounding that derailed your destiny. Because when somebody comes into our office today, they're coming in to talk about something that happened 2 weeks ago or a month ago. And as you know, through analysis, we have to get back to the source, to that original wounding that often happened in childhood. Now, we oftentimes find that this wounding occurred in a former lifetime, perhaps 2,000 years ago, where our client will experience themselves suffering, experiencing trauma that repeats itself over and over again, over many lives. Now, of course, this doesn't prove that reincarnation exists. It simply proves that this is a story that lives inside our client. But it's a living story within them,
mm-hmm.
which is more of a metaphor for the trauma that occurred. So during soul retrieval, we journey back to the original wounding, and we coax back that part of the self that splintered, that became fragmented. We bring back those energetic resources and reinstall them in the psyche so that we don't have to keep recreating the conditions of the original wounding through our next job or our next relationship in the hopes of trying to heal it. And after we do that, we learn that it's possible also to journey forward along your timeline to find and install a desirable future, a desirable destiny.
Is this stage four?
And this is, no, this is the intervention number three,
okay,
the soul retrieval and destiny retrieval process.
Okay.
And the fourth is the great rites of passage, which include the rites of puberty, of first menstruation for a woman, of manhood, of womanhood, of marriage, of divorce, of motherhood, of menopause, and the sage rites. How do we enter into the later stages and the most creative stages in our lives? And finally, of course, the death rites, which are the great rites. And we learn those rites, which we have forgotten in the West, by actually learning the shaman's journey beyond death and discovering that on the other side of death, there's only life. And this is what allows us to assist a loved one, perhaps even the person that brought us into this world, in making their final journey peacefully. And having said the I love yous and the I forgive yous that need to be said. And you know, David, I get letters every month from people that say, that I've never met, saying, thank you for the last chapter in your book, Shaman Healer Sage. Thank you. I was able to help my mother to die. I was able to help my child to die. And they're such touching notes that we get, mm-hmm, and comments that we receive. Because these are the rites, we've forgotten these in our culture. We put the dying away where we don't have to see them. We believe that it's contagious in some way. So this is what we train our students in. And the and if anyone is interested in more information, they should visit our website, which is www.thefourwinds, that's T-H-E-F-O-U-R, W-I-N-D-S, thefourwinds.com.
I'll also put a link to that in the show notes on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Where do you see the Four Winds Society going? What's your dream in terms of the future?
Well, I think that healing today is not only and spirituality is not only a personal phenomena, but it's a political phenomena. I think that we have to bring healing to our families, to our schools, to our organizations, to our belief systems, to the paradigms that we hold about the nature of sustainability or ecology or carbon dioxide emissions. So I see our work becoming increasingly political in the old sense of the word politics, in the sense that it's the totality of humanity, that we're here to dream a new kind of world into being, the kind of world that we want our children's children to inherit, which is not the probable world, but it's the possible world, no matter how improbable. So this is what I hold as the greater task for the Four Winds. We want to change the world one healer at a time, mm-hmm, one shaman at a time, and help them discover the tools that can allow them to change and bring beauty and healing to many people in their communities.
Has there been a time in your own journey in which your knowledge of either psychology or your involvement with these shamanic practices pulled you through?
Would you repeat that, please, David?
Yeah. Has there been a time in your own journey, in your own life, in which your knowledge of either psychology or your involvement with these shamanic practices somehow pulled you through?
That happens about twice a month for me.
Can you give us an example?
You know, one of the prophecies of the Americas, of the medicine peoples of the Americas, is that in the year 2012, by the year 2012, there's going to be a tremendous upheaval and a revisiting of all of the things that we assume and take for granted in the West. And I see that happening internally in people. I mean, not only are economics and war and violence affecting us, but there's an internal reevaluation that's happening. I remember 10 years ago, I knew two or three people that were in crisis. And today, most everyone I know two or three people that are not in crisis. And in my own life, I've had to reevaluate what it means to be a man, what it means to be a father, what it means to be accomplished, what success means, what aging means. How do I turn that which has been a source of great wounding in my own past into a source of compassion? So I believe that the tools of psychology and spirituality and shamanism are to be used like a muscle on a daily basis. And the more you exercise it, the fresher that you remain, the less that lifelessness settles into your joints and into your psyche. And to me, it's a daily practice. I wake up in the morning and I go, who am I today? And how can I be of service?
Oh, that's great. I tell you, very inspiring just listening to you. Of your many books, which would you most strongly recommend to our listeners?
Well, I would recommend Shaman, Healer, Sage.
Okay.
And also, my newest book is called Mending the Past and Healing the Future Through Soul Retrieval. And they're both very practical books. They provide you with the techniques and the processes that the reader can do to a great degree to heal at a core level of our being, at the essential energetic level of our being.
Is there a book by some other author that you would recommend who's to the interested listener who wants to learn more about shamanism?
I think to learn more about shamanism, you have to go to Joseph Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to the mythologists. You have to look at the history of the divine from the perspective of the feminine. Go to Maria Gimbutas, the anthropologist who discovered all the Paleolithic goddess figures in Central Europe. Go to a book called The Goddess, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. But I would start with Campbell because he gives us the language of images and myth and of the feminine that is so essential.
Yeah. You know, I've been teaching out of Joseph Campbell for 25 or 30 years, and he certainly ranks up at the top for me, too. Well, look, I know that I've interrupted your writing morning here, so I really want to thank you for giving us so generously of your time and your wisdom to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have been with you, David, anytime. And thank you for inviting me to the show.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I don't get to see Alberto or spend time with him nearly as much as I would like to. That might be changing, however. Over the dinner that I refer to in the interview, he invited me to consider working with him as one of his workshop leaders. I'm very flattered to be offered this opportunity. As I've remarked in previous episodes, I'm interested in leading my life as intuitively as possible. When an opportunity such as this suddenly appears out of nowhere, I feel an obligation to follow up and see where it might lead. So I've begun Alberto's latest book, Mending the Past and Healing the Future, and I plan to attend a training that he'll be leading in Park City, Utah this coming July, and then we'll see whether it feels like a good fit for both of us or not. Much like dream work, the Tarot deck can be a useful tool for getting in touch with your own intuition. After our dinner, I went home and consulted the tarot by shuffling the deck and pulling a random card. The card that came up for me is called the Chariot. And this card depicts a young prince whose chariot is being drawn by two sphinxes, one black and one white. On his shoulders, the prince wears epaulets, which are half moons, and the moon is associated with the feminine and with intuition. The white sphinx has black stripes in his headdress, and the black sphinx has white stripes in his. So these two creatures are suggestive of yin and yang, the balancing of opposites. Somehow this card seems particularly fitting. It suggests to me that I should proceed on this journey, but also that I will need to harness powerful forces that might tempt to pull me one way or the other. I'll need to listen to my intuition and steer a course between the extremes. I'll keep you posted as the journey unfolds.
I'm Jack Ward from the Sonic Society podcast, and you're on the couch with Shrink Wrap Radio. Dr. Dave will be back in a moment.
Hey, Jack, thanks again for that very cool transition. I want to acknowledge that today's episode is sponsored by GoDaddy.com. An investment of $6.95 might just be the best investment of your life. Just think, if years ago you had thought to buy the domain name of pharmacy.com or pets.com or one of any number of other such generic names. Some people who had that foresight to buy domain names such as these were later able to sell them for millions. The fact is, you can buy yourself a little piece of the internet for a dirt cheap price. And as a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, if you use the special discount code of SHRINK3, that's SHRINK and the numeral 3, you can buy your own .com domain name at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95. That's a $2 saving off their regular price. And I have other GoDaddy discounts for you, which you can find out about by going to my site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Hey, a funny thing happened yesterday. I was in the car with my son, Jonathan, and he suggested that he'd like to hear the latest Shrink Wrap Radio episode. So we were listening to the last episode, number 30, with Stanley Krippner. And near the end, we come to the place where I hear myself say, "Okay, that's it for the mail." I couldn't believe my ears because I hadn't read any mail. I said to Jonathan, "Did I miss something? Did you hear me read the mail?" I knew I had copied and pasted some email that I had intended to read. So when I got back home, I went back through the episode again, and sure enough, I somehow skipped over reading the mail I had intended to share. So, without further ado, here is the mail that didn't get read in that last episode. First, there was one from Ned in Australia, who had written previously, and she writes, "I was pleasantly surprised when I heard you read out my long email on your podcast. This opportunity for a little more interactive communication is a lovely aspect of the medium, and it somehow allows us to close the loop in the virtual world. I did enjoy your latest show, number 28, a most interesting interview with Dr. Craig Chalquist. What an unusual and intriguing field of study. Your discussion with him triggered plenty for me to think about and follow up. Kind wishes for your continued podcasting from Ned in Australia." And then there was another one from Australia that reads, "Hi, just a note to let you know how much I enjoy the show. In particular, what I find great is the overview on subjects like Gestalt, NLP, Jungian archetypes, etc. Really, I've found your show to be the best source of up-to-date and comprehensive summaries of these fascinating subjects that I've come across. And as an amateur autodidact in this sphere, I find them invaluable. Please keep up the great work. Regards," and that's from Peter in Australia. Autodidact, what a great word. That's not one you come across often. Only an autodidact would use autodidact. And I mean that in the best possible way. More recently, I received a very interesting email from Julianne, who is an American living in London and studying there. She says, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I recently discovered your podcast and have been dipping into episodes in a fairly random order. I'm very interested in dreams for a number of reasons, but I'm plagued with nightmares nowadays, which is a typical side effect of some of my medications. I live with constant pain and many other disabling conditions," she adds parenthetically. "When I tried to experiment with dream incubation by asking myself the salient question over and over before sleep, I wound up two nights running with series of nightmares that did not appear to be related to the question. I'd be interested in what that question was, just out of curiosity. Just now, she says, I listened to your episode 22, Snakes and Maidens, and I'm struck by your statement that dialogue in dreams is often very meaningful. Does this apply to things which you say yourself in these dreams? What if in the dream the words are ineffective at obtaining the result you desire? Werewolves wanted to live in my house, and I kept telling them to go away, but they would only go for a few minutes at most. Eventually, I gave up, and while I was distressed that they often murdered people, they never harmed me. So the words I said failed to get rid of them. I can think of a number of parallels in my life with illness and whatnot, but I'm just curious as to whether the words themselves have any significance in that sort of situation. I really enjoy your show and look forward to listening to the rest of the episodes this week. Julianne. Julianne is also a podcaster, and I checked out her podcasts. I recommend them to you. They have to do with what she's going through in dealing with chronic illness. One is called It Won't Kill You, and the other is called Sick and Tired. Julianne, let me try to speak to your question. I did indeed say that when we hear a voice, when we hear dialogue in a dream, often it can be quite significant. However, I don't think that applies in the same way to the things that you say. It sounds like you were able to achieve a certain degree of lucidity in this dream, and so that you were able to decide to try to tell these werewolves to go away. Instead, what I would suggest is that you assume that the werewolves are here, as scary as they are, that they are potentially helpers and allies, and see if you can win them over and get them to give you their gift or give you their message. Offer them food. These suggestions come from the Senoi, a Malaysian tribal group that raised their children with these sorts of teachings, and a lot has been written on this subject. I'm sure you could find more on it if you search on the web under Senoi, S-E-N-O-I.
Hey, Dr. Dave. Jerry Trumbull here. I just finished listening to your podcast number 30 with Dr. Krippner, and I had to respond by telling you I think it's one of the best that you've done so far. I love the guy, and he certainly comes across as being a very scientifically oriented person who has probably done a lot to dispel some of the, some of the beliefs that people have about these kinds of things. On the other hand, giving credence to some as well. Very good interview, high technical quality as usual, and congratulations on something that I think you might consider releasing in a different format, perhaps a CD, a collection of the best of Dr. Dave. Think about it. Could happen.
Hey, Jerry, thanks for that voicemail. Regular listeners will recognize Jerry Trumbull as my guest from episodes 3 and 4, and he and I are in regular contact with one another, and he's been a strong supporter of my efforts here. Finally, I want to thank the listener who sent me an email a couple of weeks ago alerting me to a problem downloading episodes number 1 and number 25 from iTunes. If you're catching up on back shows, these were both great episodes, and they now seem to be working properly, both on iTunes and on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Okay, that's it for the mail, and this time I think I did actually read the mail. Next week, I'll be interviewing Toronto artist Jennifer Linton, who will share her experience of using art to work through issues of early childhood abuse. I think you'll want to listen to it. I'd love to hear from you. Please send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Our show notes are at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. I was really, really pleased to get Jerry Trumbull's voicemail. I'm just not getting enough voicemail. It's so easy. You can leave voicemail for ShrinkPod on Skype or Gizmo Project. And also, we have a phone in the U.S. where you can leave a voicemail. And that number is 206-888-2746. Stay tuned after our closing theme music to hear the PodSafe music selection Come Away With Me by Isaac Angel, who is a San Franciscan of Turkish-Israeli extraction. I'm really enjoying the synchronicities that happen around finding just the right music for these podcasts. This flamenco-flavored tune perfectly complements our interview with Alberto Violdo. Not only does it have the requisite Latin flavor, but the words, if you listen closely, dovetail nicely with the shamanic practice of journeying. Go to the show notes to find links to Isaac Angel. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Come away.